So yeah, okay. So last time we started talking about inflation. So today I want to talk about the perturbations from inflation. Okay. So just intuitively, I want you guys to have like the following like broad brush picture. Okay. So yesterday we started talking about this analogy, between the equation of motion for the inflaton field, and some like ball rolling down a potential, right? So this is like V of phi and phi. And so we made this analogy, between how phi evolves to this, simple physics one problem, right? So the equation of motion that we had derived last time was phi double dot plus 3h phi dot plus v prime equals zero. So we can think of this as the classical solution for the field's evolution. But in addition to this classical evolution, there's also quantum mechanical fluctuations on top of that. And so instead of thinking of this as just like a single value for the field, uniform everywhere throughout all of space, so instead we'll have like, like a distribution of values of the fields. Okay. Now these quantum fluctuations in the field value are important because, as we're going to see in the next 4 hours, so these fluctuations in the field value, those fluctuations are what gives rise to the curvature and the density fluctuations that we see in the CMB and large-scale structure and so on. Okay. Now there's lots of different but equivalent ways to compute these fluctuations. So here I'll just focus on the very simplest, like physics one way, to think about these fluctuations. And so what I'll do is to make an analogy between this field and the simplest quantum mechanical system that you guys have seen back in your kindergarten days, which is the harmonic oscillator. Yes, everything reduces to the harmonic oscillator. Okay, so let me just remind you what you guys did in kindergarten. Okay, so you guys saw that the equation of motion for the harmonic oscillator is x double dot plus omega x equals zero. And then the classical solution to this I'll write as some function v of t, which scales proportional to e to the plus or minus I omega t. So in the quantum harmonic oscillator, what we do is to promote the position x to an operator, and we write it as a sum of, as a sum of creation and annihilation operators. Okay, so we write this x operator as this classical solution v of t times times annihilation operator plus v star of t times a creation operator. We normalize this x such that the commutator with its conjugate momentum gives gives I h bar. Okay, so we normalize x such that xp is I, h bar equals one. And then this fixes the normalization of this function v. Okay, so setting this equal to I h bar tells us that this v has to be normalized such that v squared is equal to 1 over 2 omega. Okay, so therefore this function v becomes e to the I omega t divided by square root of 2 omega. Okay, so now if we take this definition of the x operator, we can then work out the variance, okay, in the ground state of the position of the harmonic oscillator. Okay, and so plugging in this expression for v, what we get is that this variance is just v squared, okay, which is 1 over 2 omega. Okay, and so now what we'll do, is to use this standard result and to work out the fluctuations in the value of the inflaton field phi, okay, during slow roll inflation. Okay, so yeah, so just like x here, what we'll do is to promote phi to be an operator, and then we'll write down its fluctuations in terms of the classical solution to its equation of motion. Okay, and so the first thing we'll do then is to write down the equation of motion for this scalar field phi. So last time we had worked out the equation of motion, okay, for a smooth, unperturbed, solution that was, that was spatially uniform everywhere. If we instead allow for perturbations, okay, so now if we allow for phi is equal to to this previous solution that I'll write as, say, phi zero plus delta phi, okay, where again, this phi zero solves that previous unperturbed equation, okay? Then you can show using the same reasoning that we used to derive this, you know, that the equation of motion for this delta phi becomes delta phi double dot plus 3h delta phi dot minus grad square delta phi plus v double prime delta phi is equal to zero. Okay, so there are a couple of subtleties in this expression. Okay, so first of all, since we're since we're looking at perturbations to the field value, I should also consider perturbations to the metric. When we write down the equation of motion for phi. Okay, so in general, there should be terms like our capital phi or capital psi in this equation of motion. However, what I'll do is to use our gauge, our freedom to choose any gauge we want, to make this problem convenient. And so, what I'll do is to pick a gauge in which the metric perturbations do not appear in this equation of motion, okay? So that gauge choice is called spatially flat gauge. And if you want, I can write down the form of the gauge, but again, for the interest of time, I don't need to write it down, okay? But if you want to, I can, if you want to, I can write it down. Okay. It would be, okay, yeah, so the form of the spatially flat gauge is the S squared is minus 1 plus 2a dt squared, okay, minus 2 scale factor vector b, dt dxi plus a squared, and then the Euclidean metric delta ij dxi dxj. Okay, and so you can verify for yourself that for this choice of gauge, this a and this b do not appear in delta phi's equation of motion. Okay, good. The next point that I'll note is that, okay, so this is the equation of motion for this small perturbation delta phi. This v double prime is of order a slow roll parameter, eta. So therefore, v double prime delta phi has two small things in it, and therefore I will neglect this term. Okay? So, good. So now we'll drop this, giving us a slightly simpler expression. Okay? Good. So now what I'll do is to try to make this equation of motion look like the harmonic oscillator equation of motion. Okay? So the first thing we'll do is to change coordinates from proper time t and and physical position x to co-moving x and conformal time. Okay, so previously we've seen conformal time, so if you recall, conformal time was defined by eta is the integral of dt over a, okay, which we said last time is the integral of dA over A squared H. Okay, so again, just to be clear, this eta here is the conformal time, is not the slow roll parameter eta that we saw last time. So again, sorry for the repeated notation. Okay, now, one issue is that during inflation, this eta conformal time is not convenient because it behaves it behaves badly, okay? So you can see this by setting h constant in this integral, okay? So if we set h constant, this integral becomes, dA over a squared, from some initial a to some final a, okay? Which is 1 over a naught h minus 1 over a h at the end. Now, the problem is that this a naught at the start of inflation is like 60 e folds smaller than this a, towards the end, right? So therefore, this term is enormous compared to this term, right? So therefore, as we change the endpoint of inflation, this integral doesn't really change, right? This term just dominates no matter what this term is, okay? And so for that reason, this coordinate is not terribly useful because it's like basically independent of when inflation ends, okay? Right, yeah, okay, right, yeah. So it's eta is totally dominated by this first term. And then yesterday we saw that that's just the way that we say that inflation solves the horizon problem, if you recall from yesterday. Okay, so, right, so, but for the purposes of this calculation, this annoyance, you know, makes things a little bit inconvenient. And so therefore I will slightly change time coordinates, okay? So I'll define a new time coordinate, tau, which is just eta, relative to the end of inflation. Okay, so I'll define tau as eta minus eta at the end of inflation. Okay, and so that's just 1 over a end, inflation minus 1 over ah. Okay, and now the nice thing is that is that at the end of inflation, a is a huge number, so therefore now this is negligible compared to this. Okay, so therefore for most of the times during inflation, this is minus 1 over ah. Okay, good. So, right, okay, so again, so this tau is a conformal time in the sense that, you know, d tau is equal to d eta, is equal to dt over a, right? Okay, but note though that tau equals 0 at the end of inflation, and so therefore before the end of inflation, tau is negative in value. Okay, right. Also, as we just noted, okay, so tau is basically like minus 1 over ah. Okay, so in magnitude, tau is, you know, basically 1 over ah. Okay, right. So therefore, the absolute value of this, you know, of this time coordinate tau tells us this, tells us this apparent horizon size. Okay, while we're inflating, okay? So the picture to have in mind is that, you know, towards the start of inflation, tau is very large and negative, and then towards the end of inflation, tau gets small, but also still negative, okay? And yeah, and so in magnitude, tau is shrinking as time progresses. Okay, good, so now if we change from time coordinates here to tau, okay, and also if we change from proper physical derivatives to co-moving derivatives, okay, then our equation of motion becomes d squared delta phi d tau squared minus 2 over tau d delta phi dt d tau, and then minus now a co-moving spatial derivative of delta phi. Okay, so all that equals 0. Okay, so we've gotten slightly closer to our desired harmonic oscillator equation of motion, but we still have this annoying term that has one time derivative in it. And so to get rid of this middle term, what I'll do is to again change variables from delta phi to a new variable x that I'll define as delta phi is equal to x over a. Okay, and so then if we make this substitution, then this equation of motion becomes d squared x d tau squared minus Laplacian squared plus 2 over tau squared, x equals 0. And now if I Fourier transform, then this Laplacian squared becomes a minus k squared. Okay, so I get k squared minus. Okay, good. And so now, so now we have an equation of motion, which is basically in the form of our, of our harmonic oscillator equation of motion. Okay, so we have this conformal time tau instead of, proper time t. And then instead of this omega squared, we have this quantity in the parentheses, k squared minus 2 over tau squared. Okay, so the solution to this equation of motion is the following. So we get v of tau is equal to e to the minus ik tau. Normalization is 2k. And then 1 minus I over k tau. Okay, good. So now what we'll do, in a moment, then is to then express the RMS fluctuations in x and phi in terms of this classical solution. But before that, let's just first very briefly examine the form of this solution. Okay, so again, recall that tau is getting smaller in magnitude as time progresses. Okay, so early on, k times tau is large and negative. Late times, k times tau is small. And again, that should make sense because, again, this tau is like 1 over ah. Okay, so therefore, k times tau is like k over ah, right? So this k times tau is basically k in horizon units. Okay, right, so early on at the start of inflation, right, modes are inside the horizon such that k over ah, which is k times tau, is large, right? Modes that are inside the horizon, they have large wave numbers, okay? And then as time progresses, this k times tau becomes small, i.e. modes leave the horizon. Okay, so then let's consider the behavior in two different regimes when this k times tau is large or small, meaning either inside or outside the horizon. Okay, so first let's look at the behavior when k times tau is large, okay? Which again means, you know, modes that are inside the horizon. Okay, so when this k times tau is large, then this I over k tau becomes negligible compared to the one, right? And so you can see then that the solution then just becomes, you know, the standard harmonic oscillator solution, e to the I omega t, with some normalization. Okay, and again that should make sense because for modes that are deep inside the horizon, space just looks like normal Minkowski space. Okay, so therefore the normal harmonic oscillator solution should apply. The other limit, okay, yeah, so let me just say, so this matches the harmonic oscillator. Okay, now the other regime is also interesting. Okay, so in the other limit of k tau much, much less than one, okay, which is again is modes outside the horizon. Okay, so there are two differences compared to what we got before. Okay, so when k times tau is small, then this term is much larger than the one, okay, which therefore changes the normalization of this. Okay, but the more maybe physically interesting difference is that now in the exponent, okay, this k times tau stops changing. Okay, right, so therefore the solution stops oscillating. Okay. Oscillating. Okay, and so the way that we, you know, so the way that we interpret this is that for modes that are outside the horizon, these quantum fluctuations stop oscillating in time and get frozen in time. Okay, and so the way that people say this, you know, sort of qualitatively is that so once modes exit the horizon, the fluctuations in those modes get frozen in and therefore turn into classical fluctuations in the field value. Okay, so therefore the quantum fluctuations that we saw, initially inside the horizon. Okay, once you exit the horizon, they turn into classical fluctuations in the value of phi. Okay, so if we return to this picture we had before, all the way over here, of this phi rolling down its potential, okay, so initially while we were inside the horizon, we just have this constant fluctuating, oscillating perturbations, but once you leave the horizon, then these fluctuations stop oscillating in time, they get frozen in, okay? They get frozen in, with different values at different locations, okay, so therefore, spatially, we get different values for phi at different locations at the same time. Yeah.
What do we mean by classical fluctuations? Are those like the different values that you just?
Very good. So that's the picture intuitively to have in mind. Okay. So for modes that are well outside the horizon, okay, you know, going classical, you can just think of it as just meaning that the value of phi, the value of phi is slightly displaced from this unperturbed solution by some small amount equaling that delta phi that, you know, I mean, yeah, so I mean, so delta phi that we just computed. Okay, good, right. So, okay, so yeah, so good. So, yeah, so I'll say it again, right. So these classical perturbations, they're equivalent to having small perturbations in the value of this classical solution, the unperturbed solution phi naught, that randomly fluctuate from region to region in space. Okay, so now again, we can write down the variance in those fluctuations the same way that we did before using the harmonic oscillator. Okay, so x squared, again, will just be this v squared. So therefore, the variance of delta phi, okay, is therefore the variance of x over a squared, which is v squared over a squared. Okay, and now for modes that are well outside the horizon, okay, this term is much larger than the one, and so therefore I'll just neglect the one. Okay, so therefore this becomes, so we got a 1/2 when we square. We have k to the 3/2 squared gives me k cubed. Okay. Okay, we have tau squared. We have a squared. Okay. Right. And then the next step that I'll use is that tau is approximately equal to minus 1 over ah. Okay, so therefore then this is approximately equal to h squared over 2k cubed. Okay, so this is the variance in the perturbations to the value of this field as a function of the wave number k. Right? So any questions about that? So this is the variance of the Fourier transform of delta phi. And then by the Wiener-Khinchin theorem, we can then relate this to the variance of phi in real configuration space. Okay, so to remind you about how that looks. Okay. So the variance in real space we can write as a sum over all of these all these Fourier space modes. Okay, so we can write that sum as an integral over d3k, again over 2 pi cubed, okay, of this quantity that we just computed, this delta phi of k squared. So this only depended on the magnitude of k, so then let me write this d cubed k as 4 pi k squared dk. Okay, so a standard notation is to write this as some integral over log k. Okay, so standard notation is to write this as an integral over of dk over k times a quantity called delta squared of k, where you can see that therefore this delta squared of k is defined to be k cubed times this variance, this power spectrum of delta phi, divided by, so we have 4 pi over 2 pi cubed, works out to 2 pi squared. Okay, so good. So if we plug in this expression for this power spectrum of phi, we can see that this delta squared boils down to h over 2 pi squared. Okay, so one thing you'll notice is that this looks independent of k. All right, so as long as the Hubble expansion rate during inflation remains constant, okay, then you can see that we have a scale invariant spectrum of these of these delta phi perturbations. Okay, and again, so the spectrum is scale invariant just means that this is independent of k, and the reason why it was independent of k. Again, just as because during inflation, the Hubble expansion rate is almost constant. Okay, so it's a scale invariant because H is almost constant. Yeah?
But this is just for the modes outside the horizon.
That's right.
And these modes outside of horizon, what will happen for the V is that it's actually decaying. We don't have the oscillating part. So, like, we don't have that, like the thing that you were talking about yesterday, that in the oscillating part we have this field, this...
These are the fluctuations around that mean solution that we talked about yesterday at the end after, you know, I mean, well, right, like most of you weren't here for that, but yeah. Right, but again, so this is not the mean value phi naught, this is the fluctuations around phi naught.
But like, we're looking at the full potential. That's the V tau full potential.
So this is the classical solution for this perturbation delta phi around the mean phi naught.
Okay, so we still have the oscillating point.
So the mean will do whatever it's doing. This is the equation of motion for the perturbations around that mean. Yeah.
So but this is still true that we only have this scale invariant fluctuations for the modes that are outside of horizon. The modes that are inside of horizon, they don't have a scale invariant.
Oh yeah, that's right. But those modes we can't see because they are like super microscopic, right? So again, horizon at the time of the gut scale is, I mean, well, I don't know. I mean, I probably can't even draw it with my hands, but yeah, it's really tiny, okay? Here we're talking about the modes that will eventually produce the temperature, curvature, density fluctuations that we see on the sky around us in the universe, yeah. And so those modes are, of course, very clearly far, far outside the horizon during inflation, yeah. Okay, good. So again, we have this almost scale invariant spectrum, okay? So I say almost because H isn't exactly constant, okay? So as the, so as the mean solution is slowly rolling down its potential, okay, V is slowly decreasing as you roll down the potential, and so therefore H is slowly decreasing as we progress forward in time, okay? So yesterday we had defined this slow roll parameter, epsilon, which quantifies how fast the Hubble parameter changes as a function of time. Right, so yesterday we had defined epsilon as the time derivative of 1 over h. Okay, so the fact that this epsilon is tiny, but, you know, I mean small, but not zero, means that therefore this h isn't exactly constant. Okay, so if we do this calculation a little bit more carefully, accounting for the fact that h is not exactly constant, okay, what you'll find is that this spectrum, okay, so the spectrum that, you know, so the spectrum we computed actually is this. However, though, we have to evaluate this at the time when a mode leaves the horizon. Okay, so what does that mean? So previously we had drawn that picture, if you recall, of the, you know, of this apparent horizon size as a function of time. Right, so we said that during inflation. Right, so if we plot, you know, this 1 over AH versus A, right, so it's decreasing like 1 over A, okay? So what I'm saying is that, you know, so for some mode K, right, so, you know, like, so what you do just is to draw where K is on this vertical scale. You find the time A, you know, when this mode becomes of order 1 over AH, the time when it leaves the horizon, okay? Then you evaluate AH at that time, okay? You know, so you evaluate this H at that time. Okay, good. Right. Okay, good. So therefore then this small change in H squared as a function of time, it therefore gives us a small breaking of this scale invariance, which will be of order this epsilon, this slow roll parameter. Okay, good. So questions about any of that? Yeah, so what I'm saying is that the power spectrum of, you know, of delta phi, okay, the RMS of delta phi at this k is equal to h over 2 pi squared evaluated at the time when ah equals k, roughly speaking.
So this is where k
dependence. Exactly. Okay? Exactly, right? Yeah, exactly. So the time dependence of h gives us a slight k dependence of this power spectrum, okay? A slight breaking of the scale invariance. Okay, good questions. Okay, so good. So now all this has been for the fluctuations in this delta phi. Okay, so the value of this inflaton field. Delta phi itself is not what we observe on the sky. Instead, so we see temperature, curvature, density fluctuations. So the next step then is to figure out how these delta phi fluctuations translate into the perturbations that we had talked about previously, i.e. the metric perturbations, the density perturbations, and so on. So let's do that next. So now our next thing will be to translate this delta phi into our metric potentials, like the matter fluctuations, radiation fluctuations, and so on. Okay, so the intuitive way to understand how these field value fluctuations turn into these perturbations is the following. So the argument is that inflation stops once the slow roll conditions are, once the slow roll conditions are no longer satisfied. Okay, right, so we have our potential, some shape, I don't know, whatever it is, okay. And so our field is, rolling down, say starting here and then reaching here, and so at some point, once you reach some field value, okay, the shape of V of phi locally will no longer satisfy the slow roll conditions, and therefore, inflation will stop happening, okay? And so we think of inflation as stopping once we hit some field value, okay? The fluctuations in delta phi around the mean solution translate into fluctuations in the time when some region hits this stopping point, okay? So these delta phis, okay, they turn into fluctuations in the time when inflation ends. Okay, these fluctuations in the time when inflation ends correspond to fluctuations in the scale factor produced by inflation. Okay, so to see that, this delta t, time when inflation ends, okay, is something like this delta phi divided by phi dot. Okay, and then these delta t fluctuations turn into delta a fluctuations just because delta A over A is just H delta T, okay, which is therefore H delta phi over phi dot, okay? So initially they originate as these high frequency quantum fluctuations on small scales, but as universe inflates, small scales get inflated to large scales, and we saw before that once these scales exit the horizon, then they stop oscillating, and therefore they turn classical, okay. So therefore these high frequency oscillating delta phi turn into just fixed realizations of delta phi. Okay, I haven't thought about that. As you're thinking of like delta E, delta T is bigger than H bar or something like that, is that what you mean?
So I don't think that
this delta T that we computed, then compared to like the energy scale of inflation will give us H bar. I don't know. I haven't checked. I mean, it's possible that I might, but yeah, I mean, I don't think so. So again, this dot just means d by dt, doesn't mean d by d tau or d by d eta. So we can see that these fluctuations, these spatial fluctuations in the value of phi, they correspond to local fluctuations in delta A over A. And these fluctuations are just curvature fluctuations. Okay, so before, for example, right, you know, so back in our previous Newtonian gauge, we had seen that the spatial part of the metric looks like, you know, a squared 1 plus 2 phi delta ij dxi dxj, right? And so locally, if we have fluctuations in this local value of a, that's equivalent just to having these fluctuations in this phi, okay? Okay, so that's a qualitative argument, which is sort of hand wavy. So that argument is kind of sketchy, you know, because I'm comparing this, you know, this delta phi computed in that other gauge, the spatially flat gauge, to these, to these capital phis computed in our Newtonian gauge. Okay, so that comparison isn't, it's not obvious. So the proper way to do this translation is to write down quantities that are gauge invariant. Okay, if we had more time, I would show you, that we can construct a gauge invariant quantity. Okay, out of this delta phi, out of this phi. So that quantity is called the Bardeen curvature zeta. And Bardeen showed that it's gauge invariant. So there's this gauge invariant quantity, zeta, which looks like sort of like this. And so in our previous Newtonian gauge, the zeta takes the form of minus phi minus hv, where this phi was the metric potential, and this capital V, again, was that velocity, scalar velocity perturbation we had written down. Okay, so that was in our Newtonian gauge. In this spatially flat gauge, this zeta takes the form minus h over phi dot delta phi, the thing that we just wrote down. Okay, so therefore, from the power spectrum of this delta phi that we computed, we can therefore work out the power spectrum of zeta, and therefore the power spectrum of these Newtonian gauge quantities that you guys have been working on in your tutorial. So just to write that out, okay? So the power spectrum of zeta is just what we wrote here. So it's h over phi dot square times the power spectrum of the delta phi. Okay. And then this power spectrum of delta phi is, it's erased. Here. Okay, so a squared over 2 pi cubed. Okay, so let me just write that. H squared over 2 k cubed. Now to make progress. So recall that last time, we had written this phi dot in terms of the slow roll parameter. Okay, so last time we had showed that phi dot squared is epsilon h squared over 4 pi g. Okay, so therefore then this p zeta just becomes then 2 pi g h squared over epsilon k cubed. Okay, and again, all this is evaluated again at the time when AH equals K. Okay, so you can see that the power spectrum of this Bardeen curvature is zeta, okay, so it's similar to the original power spectrum that we had for the field, H squared over K cubed, but it also has this 1 over epsilon down in the denominator, okay? So epsilon, of course, is a tiny number, so therefore this 1 over epsilon downstairs makes this, scalar perturbation, larger than it would have been. If we had had more time, we similarly would have worked out the power spectrum of gravitational wave perturbations, tensor perturbations, okay? We would have seen that the tensor power spectrum doesn't have this epsilon on the bottom, okay? So instead it's just this h squared over k cubed. If we could detect both the scalar and the tensor perturbations, we can get both the energy scale of inflation and also the slow roll parameter epsilon, okay? And so for that reason, observers want to measure both the scalar and also the gravitational wave tensor perturbations. Okay?
I just don't exactly see how a scalar fluctuations, how like scalar perturbations can translate, like how does a scalar modes talks to vector modes or tensor modes? How can they produce fluctuations?
Oh, good. Good. So the tensor fluctuations, you mean? Okay, good. So in the same way that we derive, you know, fluctuations in the value of phi, okay, we'll also have fluctuations in the metric itself.
Because of phi.
Right. Okay. And so, well, I mean, because of the energy's, you know, scale during, you know, during inflation. Okay. Right. You know. Right. Yeah. So I didn't write down tensor perturbations or their equation of motion. Okay. You know. Right. You know. If we had more time, I'd have gone through that. But the argument for these fluctuations in phi just translate directly also into, you know, the same argument for the fluctuations in the metric tensor itself. Right.
But like we cannot have vector fluctuations this way when we have a scalar field in Platon.
Oh, right. Yeah. That's right. So I think that is correct that, these vector fluctuations are not produced during inflation. Although now I can't think of an argument why that's the case. I do believe that, inflation doesn't produce these vector fluctuations. So I'll have to make sure about that,
Is this data something observed or like observable?
Not yet, But we're getting to the things that we had written down before, so the metric perturbation and also the matter radiation perturbations, okay? So for now, just the goal is to find something that is gauge invariant to let us translate from our results in one gauge to the gauge that we've been working in previous weeks, okay? And the zeta is a gauge invariant quantity, which is why people work with it. I'll also mention one other reason why it's super convenient in a moment, but you have a question?
After you finish.
Well, I mean.
I mean, after you finish answering, Sergio, can I ask them?
Why I finished, I mean, for now, I'm saying that, you know, so in like 10 minutes, I'll also mention another reason why the zeta is super, super convenient. Yeah.
Just something to make sure that I'm understanding this power spectrum of zeta, what we're talking about is that we expect this to be observable because it can be related to the power spectrum that we want to observe.
It's related to things that we will observe, that's right.
So it has the exact k dependence that the power spectrum of the inflaton field has, in the sense that like when we are translating from that to that, we're saying that.
Well, so we worked out the k dependence of zeta's fluctuations.
So we
related the delta phi fluctuations to the zeta fluctuations this way. Mm-hmm. So if we know the power spectrum of delta phi, then we know the power spectrum of zeta. That's all I'm saying.
We want to translate it to actual like a standard model power spectrum of actual standard.
Which means then now using this to translate zeta's power spectrum into the power spectrum of phi, delta matter, theta, photon, et cetera, et cetera.
But like what we're assuming is that we can have some efficient way that these special like K modes of the inflaton field can transfer energy to that specific modes in the standard model field.
I don't mean transferring energy. So there is a direct relation between this perturbation and this perturbation. So, right? So if we know the value of this.
But when we're defining it, yes.
So maybe I don't understand your question then.
No, I mean, this is power spectrum for the inflaton field. And then we define that zeta for the.
This is the fluctuation of the inflaton field. So we worked out the power spectrum of these fluctuations as a function of wave number. We worked out how the Bardeen curvature relates to the inflaton perturbation. So therefore, if we know the power spectrum of these fluctuations, we know the power spectrum of these fluctuations.
And now when we want to translate that to the power spectrum of matter, for example?
Then we'll just now then use these equations to relate the zeta perturbations to the, you know, the metric perturbations that we've been talking about previously.
I understand what you're saying, but I think we need to ask.
It's the same parameter in
different
pages.
Yeah, I understand. The only thing is that I can.
Is someone else, someone else understand the question, or because I'm missing, I think, what you're asking.
I can follow this thought line, but what I was thinking was that, why we don't need to consider how does inflaton actually transfer energy to the standard model particle in this case? What if?
Oh, you mean like reheating?
Yes, exactly.
Oh, okay.
Why it doesn't enter there?
Okay, good. So inflation ends, okay? There was all this energy density in the inflaton, okay? Today, the universe has stuff in it besides just the inflaton field, okay? And so there's some process that converts the energy density in the inflaton into everything else, the standard model. Okay, what I'm saying is that the fluctuations in all those species, those fluctuations from point to point in space, they're related to this curvature perturbation in a way that we're going to see in the next 45 minutes. Yeah. I mean, I'm not joking. I'm only halfway done. So, okay. All right. So hold your thought, I guess, for now. Okay, where was I? Okay, right. So this is the power spectrum of these Bardeen curvatures. One useful way that we can quantify the breaking of scale invariance, the shape of this power spectrum, is to define something called the spectral index of this power spectrum. So I'll define it in the following way. Okay, so let's measure d log power spectrum of zeta tk, d log k. Okay, and so then I'll define this slope of the zeta power spectrum as a scalar index minus 4. This minus 4, so this defines this ns. Okay, so looking at our expression for the zeta power spectrum, okay, so we can see then that this d log p, d log k will have, first of all, a minus 3 from this k cubed on the bottom. Okay, so this will equal minus 3 from this k cubed on the bottom, then we'll have plus 2 d log h, d log k, and then we'll have minus 1 d log epsilon d log k. Okay, recall that all these derivatives are all evaluated at the time when, a h equals k. If we do some algebra that I will skip, so you can show that this is equal to, this d log h, d log k is equal to minus epsilon, and this d log epsilon, d log k is equal to 4 epsilon minus 2 eta, where now this eta, again, is the slow roll parameter, not the conformal time, okay? So therefore, in total, putting this all together, we get that the spectral index, is 1 minus 6 epsilon plus 2 eta. Why do we care? Okay, so we care because, we'll see soon that this quantity, this ns, this ns is an observable quantity on the sky, and it's related to the shape of the potential of the inflaton. And so by measuring this ns, we can therefore constrain the shape of V of phi. Okay, or conversely, the shape of V of phi then tells us about, the shape of the power spectrum of the observed perturbations. Okay, now we said before that these slow roll parameters have to be tiny in order for inflation to occur. Okay, so therefore, the prediction from inflation is that this NS must be very close to one. So observationally, what we find is that the observed value for this NS is around 0.96. Okay? So therefore, this is actually quite a remarkable triumph for this model of inflation, okay? Because again, inflation predicts that this NS is a little bit smaller than one, and indeed that is what we see, yeah.
From what kind of observations we can calculate NS?
Okay, good. So the kind of observations are again the CMB power spectrum. Okay, so that statement might be very confusing to you because again, so this is saying that P goes like K to the NS. So this is saying that P goes like NS minus one, so for K to the minus three, so KQP of K is constant, is flat, right? I mean, rise to scale invariant. But it's saying that this P is some power law in K. The CMB power spectrum, if you recall, has all these like bumps and wiggles and things, right? And of course, this looks nothing like a power law, right? So what you guys are going to see in your tutorial, if we ever get there, is that the reason for all these bumps and wiggles is due to the physics that happens after inflation. Okay, so all of the, all the complicated interactions between the baryons, photons, et cetera, okay, they will turn this smooth power law curvature power spectrum into this like very wiggly CMB power spectrum. Okay, so what I'm saying is that observationally we measure this, and then if we try and reconstruct what the original zeta power spectrum was, what we measure is that indeed it's really, really close to a power law. Okay, and also that the power law index is very close to one, which also very close to this almost scale invariant prediction. Okay, yeah. Good. So in that sense, this is quite the triumph for inflation. So good. So let me just next then briefly talk about some of the other predictions of inflation that we've been going through. Let me erase this, I guess. Okay, yeah, so let's just briefly write down some of the predictions of inflation. Okay, yeah, so the first famous prediction, again, is this thing that we just wrote down. So a nearly scale invariant spectrum. Okay, which again is just a statement that NS is close to minus one. I'm close to one. Another important prediction of the simplest models of inflation is that the scalar perturbations should all be adiabatic. And so let me describe quickly what that means. So adiabatic perturbations. Okay, so what that word means just simply is that the perturbations look consistent with being caused by different patches of the universe having slightly different clocks. Okay, so we just saw just now that these delta phi perturbations that give you small perturbations in the ending time for inflation, and then we saw how that then translates into these curvature fluctuations. So we'll see, in a few moments, how those curvature fluctuations, we'll see how they produce density perturbations in detail. But one simple way to think about them, is in terms of these perturbations to this local scale factor, delta A over A. Okay, so those delta A over A fluctuations will produce density fluctuations. Okay, so why is that? The reason, is that the different species evolve differently over time. Okay, so for radiation, okay, so we have that rho goes like a to the minus four. For matter, we have that rho goes like a to the minus three. Okay, So if we have fluctuations in delta A, so we have fluctuations in the scale factor A, that then translates into fluctuations in, let's say, the radiation over density, delta R, delta rho over mean rho, which is just minus 4 delta A over A. Okay, similarly for the matter, we'll have that the matter over density, which is delta rho matter over rho matter, is minus 3 delta A over A. Okay? So the prediction from inflation is that this statement is true for every single point in space, okay? So we have this specific relationship everywhere, point by point in space, between like the matter perturbation, the radiation perturbation, the neutrino perturbation, and so on and so on. Okay? Right, so the prediction is that the dark matter perturbation will equal the baryon perturbation, okay, because both of them scale like a to the minus 3. It'll equal 3/4 of the photon perturbation, which will also be 3/4 of the neutrino perturbation, and so on and so on. Okay? Right, so this is called adiabatic perturbations. Okay. And this is a prediction of, for these simplest inflation models. And again, if we look at the actual observed CMB, this is exactly what we see. Okay? The CMB places very strong constraints on deviations from this adiabatic relation observationally. Okay, good. And so then the last important major prediction for the simplest inflationary models is that these fluctuations should be almost Gaussian distributed. Here, I'll write that here. Okay, so Gaussian perturbations. Okay, and the reason for this we discussed last time, okay? So the reason for this again, is that during slow roll, the potential for the inflaton is like almost flat, which looks like a free field. And of course, you all know that, that the fluctuations of a free field are almost Gaussian distributed, okay? So now again, observationally, so in the CMB, we see that the CMB temperature fluctuations are indeed Gaussian to around 4 decimal places. Okay, so again, this is also a confirmed prediction of inflation. So I want to stress that all of these things, okay, so these very generic predictions for inflation, okay, which is a nearly scale invariant spectrum of adiabatic perturbations that are almost Gaussian distributed, okay? Those are all predictions of this model, okay? So inflation made these predictions long before the observations were made to test those predictions. And all three of these were indeed verified, okay? And that's on top of course, the fact that inflation solves all those previous problems like the horizon problem, the flatness problem, the monopole problem, and so on, okay? And so for these reasons, almost everyone in cosmology, strongly believes that something like inflation must have occurred back in the early universe. Okay. Okay. Good. So, we're out of time, but let me just go on for a few more minutes, maybe 10 more minutes, if that's okay with you guys. So all this was the perturbations that are produced by inflation. The last thing I want to talk about next is, how these perturbations then evolve after inflation. Okay, so let's do that really quickly. I'll do that here. Okay, yeah, so last thing we'll do is the evolution after. Inflation. Okay, so, so in our previous weeks, we had worked out the evolution equation for the various Newtonian gauge perturbations, right? And so in principle, we can now work out the evolution after, following the end of inflation just by using those equations that we worked out before. All we have to do is to take our perturbations, the zeta perturbations, and then translate them into the quantities that we've been working with before. So delta matter, the metric potentials and so on. Okay. So the first problem in doing that, you know, is that so far we've been working in this spatially flat gauge. Our perturbations were in the conformal Newtonian gauge, and so therefore we have to translate. And so as we said just now, you know, so we can translate using our gauge invariant perturbation zeta. Okay. So as we said before, in Newtonian gauge, zeta was given by minus our metric potential phi minus hv. Okay, where again this v was that was that scalar velocity perturbation. So in previous classes, we talked about how to write this v in terms of the other metric perturbations using the Einstein equations. Okay, so if you check your notes, you'll see how we talked about how we can write this v in terms of phi and psi. Okay, so using the time and the time space Einstein equations. So what we showed previously was that d phi dt minus h psi is 3/2 1 plus w times h squared v. Okay, where again this w is the average equation of state for all the contents in the universe. Okay, so therefore now we can replace this hv with this. Okay, so this is equal to minus phi minus now all of this stuff, so d phi dt minus h psi, all of that over 3/2 1 plus w times h. So now what we'll do, following end of inflation is to convert from zeta into phi and psi. Okay, so the first step is to recall that at the end of inflation, the co-moving apparent horizon, this, says 1 over ah, is really tiny, right? So our statement was that modes have all exited the horizon, right? Okay, so just to remind you, we had this picture, 1 over ah, and then modes are exiting the horizon. Depending on how large those co-moving modes were. Okay, so inflation ends at some very late time, after which all the observable modes are all much, much larger than the horizon. Okay, good. So then for that reason, let's first consider the evolution of the perturbations in the regime when they're outside the horizon, when k is small compared to ah. So it turns out that the evolution of these modes is actually really simple. Okay, so if we take a time derivative of this zeta, we can show that its time derivative takes the following approximate expression. So d zeta dt is approximately equal to minus 2w over 3, 1 plus w, times Laplacian of phi over a squared h. Okay, if we Fourier transform this expression, then this Laplacian becomes a minus k squared. And then if we divide both sides by h, okay, so dividing both sides by h, and this d by dt becomes a d by d log a. Okay, So for scales that are far outside the horizon, where k is much, much less than ah, you can see that we have k over ah quantity squared. So therefore, this is really tiny. So therefore, zeta doesn't change much in time. Okay, so therefore, for k much, much less than ah, we get that the zeta is almost constant in time. Okay. And this result that zeta is almost constant in time, so that fact is also, part of the reason why the zeta, turns out to be such a useful quantity, because whenever you have something conserved, it's useful. Okay, good. So because zeta is almost constant in time, then it means that in our expression, we can drop the time derivatives for phi. Okay, so therefore, let me do that. So I will drop this. Okay, and now these H's cancel, and these minus signs cancel. Okay, the next thing I'll do is to use the fact that at very early times, phi is about equal to minus psi. Do you guys remember why? Yeah, so it's because the anisotropic stress is super tiny. And do you guys recall why that's super tiny? Even though back then everything is highly relativistic. So this is like super early, long before any kind of BBN or, you know, before the electroweak symmetry breaking scale.
Like they don't have any traction and we don't have any noise?
Oh, the opposite, right? They're scattering so much that they have no quadrupole left over, right? Okay, so for that reason, psi is equal to minus phi. Okay, so therefore this is equal to minus 1 plus 2 over 3, 1 plus w. Okay, all of this times phi. Okay, good. So now we have a way to translate the Gaussian invariant Bardeen curvature perturbation into our perturbation phi, the metric perturbation in our gauge. Okay, so one interesting thing to note is that even though zeta is constant in time, phi can be not constant in time when w changes. Okay, so for example, okay, so during inflation when we have w about equal to minus 1, okay, then we get that phi and psi, you basically vanish. However, though, during radiation domination, when we have w as about 1/3, okay, then we find that phi is about minus 2/3 of zeta. And in matter domination, when w is close to 0, then we get that phi is equal to minus 3/5 of zeta. Okay? So if we compare these last two expressions, okay, we can see that, so if we compare phi, phi after matter radiation equality to the phi before radiation equality, we can see that his value slightly changes. Okay, so how much does it change by? So if we just plug in those numbers, you can see that taking the ratio of this divided by this, okay, you can see that that ratio works out to, so phi at matter radiation domination of k is equal to 9/10 of phi during radiation domination at the same k, okay? And so you guys may have seen that in your tutorial when you guys solve for the evolution of phi. Okay, so you may have seen that when you plotted phi as a function of time, it was constant, 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 and then slightly dipped, constant, constant, constant. Yeah, so this is why. Okay. Okay, good. Right, good. So now we've set the initial conditions for the metric perturbations. We can also similarly set the initial conditions for the density perturbations. Okay, so we can do that using the fluid equations that we derived before. So let's do that. Okay, so to remind you, the Poisson equation that we derived before from the time-time part of the Einstein equation was the following. So we derived that 1 over a squared grad squared phi plus 3 h squared psi minus h d phi dt is equal to minus 4 pi g delta rho. Okay, so right, so that was our previous time-time Einstein equation. Okay, so on super horizon scales, the spatial derivatives become negligible. Okay, so therefore I will drop them. Okay, we also just said that the time derivative of phi is also negligible. Okay, so therefore I will also drop that. Okay, good, so, right, so therefore 3a squared phi is minus 4 pi g delta rho, and then from the Friedmann equation, this is minus 3 halves h squared times the total perturbation to the energy density. Okay, right, where was I? So therefore now solving for delta total so psi is minus phi, so therefore we can see that therefore this delta total is 2 times phi. Okay? So to remind you, what is this delta total? This is just the total perturbation to the energy density. So its delta total is rho radiation, delta radiation plus rho matter, delta matter, plus et cetera, all that divided by the total energy density, rho radiation plus rho matter, plus so on. Okay, and so if the universe, for example, in a following inflation becomes totally radiation dominated, then this delta total is just delta radiation. Okay, but because the perturbations are all adiabatic, okay, we also then have that delta matter is, as we said before, 3/4 of delta radiation, and so on for all the species. Okay, so therefore now we know how to translate from zeta to phi and zeta to delta matter, delta radiation, delta baryon, delta neutrino, everything. Okay, the last thing we need for a complete set of initial conditions is the velocity perturbations. Okay, we can also get those. So recall that the continuity equations took the form of d by dt, delta matter plus divergence of velocity plus 3 d phi dt is equal to 0. Okay, so right, so this is for let's say the dark matter perturbation, and for the photon perturbation we have a similar equation d delta naught dt plus 1 over a divergence of the dipole plus d phi dt equals 0. Okay, and so on for the neutrinos, baryons, and so on. Okay, so again, so on super horizon scales, we can neglect these spatial derivatives. Okay, so we drop these. Okay, so therefore, yeah, so d by dt of delta d is about 1/3 d phi dt. Okay. Okay, and then similarly, d theta dt is about equal to minus d phi dt. Okay, good.
But
we can get the first derivative, right, of the density field, yeah. Okay. The reason I did this, okay, is the following. This is the temperature perturbation. Recall that the energy density perturbation of the photons is just 4 times theta naught, right? Okay. So therefore, we can see that the time derivative of d delta dt is 3/4. Of the photon dt. Okay, so why is that interesting? That's interesting because our adiabatic condition for the initial value was that they're related by 3/4, and so you can see that the time evolution also preserves that adiabatic relation. Okay. Okay, good. So I think that we have everything now needed for you guys now to evolve the perturbations as a function of time. Okay, right. So we've worked out the power spectrum of inflaton perturbations. We then translated them into the power spectrum of all of these perturbations. Okay, right, and yeah, right. So now we have all the now we have all the initial conditions, and then in previous weeks we also worked out the evolution equations. So therefore, now I think you have everything you need now to actually now do the tutorial and then see how the perturbations evolve as a function of time.
No, but now they understand why the inertial condition
is.
This
oh.
Morning, like 10 o'clock this morning.
Right, but you guys haven't then worked out the power spectra, have you? Yeah. Right, okay, yeah. So now you can, I guess, like loop over all the k's to plot, you know, to plot the power spectra of, say, the dark matter perturbations as a function of, I mean, as a function of k at some time. Yeah, and well, you'll see some interesting behavior, right? Okay, so initially it'll just trace the curvature perturbation. So initially it'll just be some power law, but you'll see that this will change as a function of time, also for the photons, et cetera, et cetera.
Can I just ask something? Yeah. Like, just because we're looking at the super horizon modes, and therefore we don't have any special, like, we can just completely neglect the special derivatives.
Yeah.
It means that, like, initial velocity field can be anything and we still get the same power spectrum?
Oh, so you're asking, okay, good. Yeah, so if we deviate from these, if we deviate from these initial conditions, what happens?
Just deviating the velocity field.
Yeah, there's velocities that are, you know, yeah, right. Yes, you're asking, what if the velocities are not in the growing mode, basically, is what you're asking. Yeah, right, yeah. And so if they're not in the growing mode, there will be transients that then decay relative to this growing mode, right?
Initial velocity field can be anything and we still get the...
Well, I mean, if you make it like, you know, 10 to the bajillion times larger than, you know, than this growing mode, I mean, right, so the growing mode grows over time, those transients don't grow over time, right, I mean, as fast, but if you make the initial amplitude too large, the growth of the growing mode might not be able to overcome that, sure.
So like when we're in simulations, like, we can simulate some particles with any initial velocity field, like, with this constraint that velocity is just be some, like, I don't know, logical value, and then just let it evolve.
And so what you'll find is that you, yeah, so if you do that, what you'll find is that you rapidly approach this solution, the growing mode, yeah. Right. However, though, in an actual simulation that you run, you want to start in the actual physical growing mode, because, of course, you know, in the time that happened before starting your simulation, the evolution was following this behavior and therefore rapidly approaches that growing mode. Yeah.
So like the claim can also be that the final evolution, matter distribution that we see in the universe, it's not a function of the initial velocity field at all.
I mean, I wouldn't say that. Again, what I would say is that I can write an arbitrary initial condition as a sum of the dominant growing mode and then also then decaying modes. Okay? The ultimate evolved solution you get will be dominated by the fastest growing mode, right? So I wouldn't say that it's dominated by the velocity. I wouldn't say that it's independent of the velocity. I would just say that you have to decompose the initial conditions into into growing modes, decaying modes, etc., right?
But since the growing mode is going to dominate, it means that velocities are not important because they're in decaying modes.
No, right? I mean, so again, right? So if I have like some, you know, some solution to some differential equation, like, I don't know, like x double prime plus a x prime plus x b equals zero, I'll have two solutions, a growing mode, a decaying mode, okay, for some general set of initial conditions involving the initial x prime, okay, I now decompose those into my growing and decaying mode. And the coefficients of those, the coefficients of the two modes depend on both the initial x and also the initial x prime, right? The same thing is true here. Okay, so thanks for bearing with me for an extra half hour. Okay, so I think then for your next tutorial, I think what we wanted you guys to do now is to, I guess, loop over all the different k's and to see how the power spectra evolve as a function of time. And then on Friday, then I'll so similarly also show you examples of how these solutions look. So maybe we'll even see how to translate from these 3D power spectra you've been computing into like a, you know, into things like the 2D CMB power spectrum. Okay, but we'll stop here for now. Thanks.